Hi, everybody. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington. Welcome back. In the second half of our conversation with Doris Kearns Goodwin, we're going to talk about Lincoln the politician, as we have been, but also we're going to assess Lincoln the military strategist and much more. The subject is Team of Rivals.
You mentioned that Frederick Douglass came to accept Lincoln, but it seems to me not unreasonable to read what you've written as indicating that Douglass himself influenced changes in Lincoln's opinion about the racial question.
No question. I think their relationship is an important relationship in history. Douglass had been so critical of Lincoln, and Lincoln used to read the speeches that Douglass wrote against him. And then when somebody said, "Why don't you go see Lincoln?" Douglass assumed he'll not want to see me, but Lincoln immediately wanted to see Douglass. And the interesting thing is, after that first meeting, even though they were still disagreeing on timing of emancipation, Lincoln so impressed Douglass without any condescension, without looking to him as a man of color, that Douglass said it was the first great white man that he'd ever lived with, who never made him feel that he was of a different color. Now, he had been with Wendell Phillips and William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionists. All of them somehow had still made him feel that he was different from them. And then they went on to continue to criticize each other. But still, by the end, I think Lincoln, by absorbing how brilliant Douglass was and what possibilities there were for blacks in America, if there were more people like Douglass who could get educated and have a chance, he began to, I think, open up more optimistically about what was possible in the country. And the great moment occurs at the second inaugural, when he invites Douglass to come to the reception. And no blacks had been invited to a social reception before, so the guards outside try to stop him from going in. But immediately, Lincoln has him brought in, and he says to Douglass, "Douglass, my friend, what did you think of my second inaugural?" And Douglass is a little awkward at first. Everybody's gathering around to give some sort of criticism. But he looks at Lincoln, and he said, "Mr. President, that was a sacred effort." And to Lincoln, that mattered more than any other opinion would have mattered.
Fairness to all, but commit me to nothing. That was said in response to queries on how to get votes in the West, Illinois and Indiana, oddly enough. How much wheeling and dealing did Lincoln actually do in order to get elected?
Well, it's interesting. You're absolutely right. He said to his handlers, or whatever we might call them, who were in Chicago, because obviously in those days, candidates never went to the conventions. They're sitting at their home waiting to hear what's happening, and they're communicating by telegraph. So he's sending a telegraph, fairness to all, as if, don't make any commitments, don't bind me. But the guys on the scene said, he's not here. He doesn't know what needs to be done. If we need to get Pennsylvania's vote by giving Cameron a promise that he'll be in the cabinet, who was a big boss in Pennsylvania, he won't know about it till later. It's all been unclear how much maneuvering went on, but clearly bargains were made. I mean, that's what it was all about in a convention system. And I think even though Lincoln might have later said he wished that hadn't happened, I'm sure he was glad that he won the election.
On the other hand, there was considerable debate, particularly in the mind of William Seward, of who selected Lincoln's cabinet. Seward, in fact, as you point out, was delayed accepting because he wanted to influence the other choices. Thurlow Weed, I love his name. Such a
Me too. Isn't that the perfect boss name?
Thurlow Weed offered help. How important was Lincoln's independence in choosing his team of rivals?
Oh, I think he chose it definitely on his own. I mean, originally what happened, it's true, he chose Seward first. Now, Seward was the clear front runner, so it made sense if he were going to put the strongest man in the country into his cabinet, he would put him in the position of primacy, which then was Secretary of State. Seward had 10,000 people at his home in Auburn the day of the convention, certain that he would win the Republican nomination. The champagne had already been uncorked, so it was an irrecoverable disappointment for him. So when Lincoln did tap him as Secretary of State, he thought, aha, this guy will just be a figurehead. Mm-hmm. Well, even if I didn't get the election, I'll be the prime minister. And Thurlow Weed and Seward figured they would choose like-minded people, pro-Seward people, for the rest of the cabinet. So Thurlow Weed goes and visits Lincoln, but finds out very quickly in that visit that Lincoln has his own ideas in mind, and he's going to appoint these former Democrats who the Weed and Seward faction hated, and they became part of the cabinet as well.
Our guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. You point out that Seward early on made two critical mistakes. He assumed that he was really in charge, and he assumed that Lincoln would abandon Fort Sumter and the South would be appeased and avoid a war. What impact did those mistakes make on the way Seward adjusted to Lincoln and his cabinet role?
Well, it's interesting. I think after even only a couple months, he wrote a letter to his wife. And at the time, at the beginning, he thought, as I say and you say, that he would be in charge. But as he saw Lincoln and how he made his decisions about Fort Sumter and make his decisions about the cabinet, he finally wrote to his wife and he said, "Lincoln is the best of us all." And once he was able to do that and abandon his own wish for primacy inside the administration, he became the best friend that Lincoln had in that cabinet. Lincoln loved nothing more than to go to Seward's house late at night, put up his feet. Seward was a Churchillian figure. He loved to drink. He loved to smoke. He had big dinner parties, and people would get mellow with fruit of the wine. And Lincoln adored being with him, and he with Lincoln, so much so that at the end of Seward's life, at the end of Lincoln's life, rather, when Lincoln had been assassinated, they didn't want to tell Seward because he, too, had been part of the assassination attempt and had almost been killed himself. And they were afraid the shock of learning that Lincoln had died would be too much for him. But at a certain point, he saw the flag at half-mast, and he said, "I know Lincoln's dead." And they tried to say, "No, no, he's not." And he said, "I know he's dead," because he had been knifed in the assassination attempt. His whole cheek had been torn off. Six people had been nearly massacred in his house. John Wilkes Booth had had three people in mind, not only Lincoln, but the vice president, the guy chickened out who was supposed to get him, but the guy got the Seward family. And he said, "I know he would have been the first person to be here if he knew what had happened to me." And then they said great tears coursed down his cheeks. It's a remarkable story of those two. I mean, that's my favorite piece of it in a certain sense.
Seward had made a speech in January 1861 intending to keep the border states in line. Apparently, the speech was not too popular. Even his wife took him through the cut for it. How sensitive were these speeches, and how many of them did Lincoln give in order to lock those border states in?
Well, you know, that was the key. Everybody assumed that if you lost the border states to the South, you'd probably lose the war. So much of the early discussion had to do with how can we show conciliation to the South so that they will stay in line. I mean, you mentioned Seward's wife. I mean, one of the wonderful thing about having these letters and diaries is the women are such interesting characters. I mean, she was a very powerful woman in her own right, great intellect, and frustrated in many ways because there wasn't a role for such a woman in her day and age. So she became his critic in a way. She would write to him and say, "I don't want to hear what you're doing. You're compromising too much." And it's wonderful to watch their banter. I mean, they loved each other very much, but she could be his best critic. Everyone else could criticize him and it would roll off him. And then Francis would send in this letter and he'd say, "Uh-oh, here she is." And that speech you refer to, she was furious because she thought it meant that he was saying he was so worried about having a war that he didn't care as much about a man emancipation as he used to care.
Our guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of Franklin and Roosevelt, and this time Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. It seems impossible now, but in 1864 it was possible that Abraham Lincoln would have lost an election, even though he himself said one of the worst things you can ever do. In fact, his political rubric was never vote against a war that your country is fighting.
Right.
It's going to come and bite you
exactly
in the rear end. How extensive was the congressional opposition to Lincoln in 1864, and how real, given the election results, were the threats that faced him of losing to McClellan?
Well, in those dark days of the summer of 1864, when it seemed like the war was at a real stalemate, so many battles had been lost, Grant hadn't made much progress toward Richmond, and the whole sense of Sherman and where he was, and the battles, it just seemed, had been one after another, either lost or stalemate. People had lost their faith that the war was going to be won. And meanwhile, the peace Democrats were gaining a certain control that maybe the only way to end this war would be to compromise with the South and leave slavery intact. So he was getting it from all different sides. And meanwhile, the radical Republicans were saying that he wasn't doing enough on his side to make sure to bring the blacks into the whole coalition in terms of doing more for the emancipated slaves. So it seemed like there was no base for him anymore in that summer. And then what happened, however, of course, is that when Atlanta fell in September, that just changed the whole context. It was as if this huge battle had been won, because up until that time, it looked like McClellan, who would be his Democratic opponent, would have those people in the country who wanted no more war. We've had too much, too many losses. It's not worth it just to emancipate the slaves, because he lost a lot of support once he emancipated the slaves from those conservatives. So he was seeming to promise a compromise with the South that would bring the war to an earlier end. The most amazing thing, though, is that everybody assumed, because McClellan had been such a popular general, that he would have the soldiers on his side. And Lincoln said at that point, "I would rather lose the election and win the vote of the soldiers than lose the soldiers' vote and win the election. And he was so happy the night of the election when 8 out of 10 soldiers voted for him, which meant they knew they were voting to prolong the war, but somehow the cause that he had made them believe in and their love for their country and for him, because he had visited them so many times and those stories got told and told and told, allowed them to say, even if I have to keep going on in this war, maybe lose my life, lose my limb, I'm voting for this man. And that, I think, was his probably happiest moment in the presidency.
Doris Kearns Goodwin, two men, military figures both, get my stomach roiling every time I hear their names. One is George Armstrong Custer, who I absolutely despise, and the other is George McClellan. For years, he has driven me absolutely nuts, and you pile it on.
I do.
You don't like him either. What was this guy, and how did Lincoln? Because I have always thought that that was one of Lincoln's errors.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Let him go on too long.
Much too patient with him.
How did Lincoln deal with this man?
Well, you know, what happens to McClellan is as soon as he gets appointed commanding general in the beginning, he makes these incredible comments to his wife that, you know, God has placed me here. In fact, I could become a dictator of this country if I want. The people love me so much. Everything's in my power. And he hated everybody that prevented him from doing exactly what he wanted. Unlike Grant, who comes in later, he travels around with an entourage. He has, you know, 1,000 carriages going everywhere he goes. And he insults other people. There's this incredible time when Lincoln goes to visit him in his house. And it turns out that McClellan hasn't come back from a wedding yet. So Lincoln waits. He's waiting with his young aide, John Hay. And finally, McClellan comes in, but he sneaks upstairs to avoid Lincoln. And the servant finally comes down and says, McClellan's gone to sleep. And they go outside, and Hay's furious. He said he thinks it's sort of a, you know, the epaulets taking over for Democratic power. And Lincoln at the time says, I'm not worrying about such matters of etiquette right now. But then later he didn't visit McClellan as much. He made McClellan visit him. But I think what happened is he saw that McClellan did have a power over the troops. The troops loved him. He could organize them. But he finally saw that he was never going to bring them into battle. And this is one letter that McClellan writes to his wife. And he said, the problem sort of is, he's saying, going into battle is, if anything happens to me, what will happen to my troops? So then Lincoln said, well, he's great at creating an engine, but it's a stationary engine. And I think he just wasn't sure who could take his place, and he wanted to believe in him to give him another chance, but obviously he didn't like him either.
What finally made him get rid of him?
Well, what he finally said was, after Antietam, he finally said that now was the time we had to go after the Southern armies because we had them on the ropes. And he told McClellan, you've got to advance, you've got to advance. And he said to himself, if he doesn't advance by a certain time, he gave himself a certain kind of discipline, then I will sack him. And he did. I mean, it was also pragmatic that it happened after the midterm elections that he finally got rid of him. So he was thinking of the right timing, but thank God he did.
Is there any connection between the firing of McClellan, Antietam, and the fact that Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation after Antietam?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what happened is he came to the idea of issuing an Emancipation Proclamation in July of 1862, and he told his cabinet, he said, I'm not asking for your opinion on whether I should do this or not. I'm going to do it, but I will think about advice on how to do it. And Seward said to him, he agreed with the idea of it, but it would be the wrong time to issue it then because battles had been lost. Wait until there's a victory, because otherwise it will look like a desperate maneuver. And so as soon as Antietam was fought, he knew that that was enough of a victory to allow him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which he then in September said, I'm doing it in January. And then, however, is when he wanted to, as I say, just make sure this war could be won. And when McClellan just kept sitting there with all sorts of excuses and all sorts of complaints, he finally got rid of him.
There were two other mistakes that Lincoln made, I think. One was personnel. Cameron, how did he ever allow himself to do that? You intimated earlier that it might be his operatives promising Cameron of Pennsylvania something in return for the Pennsylvania vote. But this guy was a disaster.
No, I think what happened is, it is true, I think he felt that some promises had been made. He knew that Pennsylvania needed to have somebody in the cabinet, because in those days you really had to satisfy certain states in the cabinet. And when he met with Cameron, Cameron was a rather folksy guy, and they could tell stories together, and I think he wasn't as taken aback by Cameron's personality, but he certainly didn't understand. The interesting thing is, Cameron wanted Secretary of Treasury. That was the important position.
Oh, yeah.
He puts him in as Secretary of War. That seems not as important. And of course, what happens makes it all important. And what happened in those early days of the war, Cameron just couldn't administer the War Department, so that contracts were given out where middlemen made away with scandalous profits for knapsacks that fell apart in the rain, diseased horses, unworkable pistols. But the amazing thing is that Cameron was then about to be censured by the Congress, and Lincoln stood up for him. It would have been the humiliating moment of Cameron's career, would have ended it probably. He said that if any fault were to be found in the chaos of those early days, it was because of the situation, that he and the entire cabinet were responsible. And Cameron said no one else would have done that. At a moment when someone was down, they'd pile on. And he said, and he finally understood that Lincoln was not like most other men.
Our guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her book is Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington. The other mistake that Lincoln may have made, and historians, I know, and politicians can argue this, was his suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. What, in fact, why did he do that, and what effect did it have on his popularity and his reputation?
Oh, I think there's no question that anybody who does go against the basic fundamental rights of liberty, even at a time of war, is going to somehow be looked at in history with a negative eye, even if it seemed necessary at the time. What was happening at the time is that in those early days of the war, when the border states were so critical, people in Maryland, for example, were preventing the troops from getting to Washington. So the whole survival of the country was at issue, because if the Southerners had been able to capture Washington, capture the seats of government, everything would have been impossible. So what he did was to have arrested some of the various people that were destroying the railroad lines, that were preventing the troops from getting there, and he did suspend their right of habeas corpus. And even at one point, the idea that maybe the legislature that was going to assemble in order to pull the Maryland out of the Union, there was some thought of suspending them. But I think he felt that this was necessary. He tried to do it as narrowly as he could for a specific purpose. But it's always one of those questions that will be controversial in time.
How much of a tactician or strategist was Lincoln during the Civil War? He at times castigated himself for being too involved, but how effective was he? How much did he understand of the battle?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you look at what he was advising the generals to do, and he was too passive probably in the beginning, he would have ideas for what we should do. For example, he always thought that we should go straight down, not take the peninsula route that McClellan
wanted.
Go down
I-95?
Just to go down I-95, because then if the Southern Army were coming up, you'd meet them and Washington would be safe. If you went through the water down to the peninsula, as McClellan wanted to, then some part of the Southern Army could come up and get Washington. And it turned out that was the right decision, what he had, but he allowed McClellan to do it the way he wanted to. And so in the beginning, when he was not at all confident about McClellan, he was much more involved, issuing orders, figuring out what should be done. Once he got Ulysses S. Grant, he knew he had the general that knew what he was doing, and he could step back from that strategy and tactics. And in fact, there's a wonderful note that he writes to Grant at one point when they had disagreed on a piece of strategy, and he said, "You were right, I was wrong." And he was glad that he was wrong, because Grant turned out to be doing the right thing.
One of the most fascinating things, when I talk about your book, I talk about this again, thinking of today. Salmon Chase leaves the cabinet, and he's opposing Lincoln after he leaves. Roger Taney, who made the Dred Scott decision, dies, and we need a new Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. Lincoln has a whole panoply of qualified men, but of all the people he could pick, he picks the most outspoken against him, Salmon Chase, with a remarkable, particularly given today's context,
absolutely,
remarkable context for that decision. Tell us about that decision.
Well, what happens is that all of his friends come to him as he's trying to decide who to appoint to the Supreme Court. He's won his second term election, although Chase tried to beat him out of it, and he doesn't like Chase. They don't get along. Chase has said terrible things about him all through the time when he was Secretary of the Treasury.
And there's a thing between his daughter and
Mary.
And
there's
the
thing between the daughter and Mary, exactly. And they say, "You can't possibly appoint this man to the Supreme Court. Look at all these things he said about you." He said, "I know meaner things that he said about me than any of you know, but I trust that this man, who had been an abolitionist, had been good to the black man, will be the best man to protect the rights of the emancipated slaves, and that's going to be the key issue that's going to come before the Supreme Court in these years ahead, even when I might not be here." And he once said, "I'd rather swallow a chair than to appoint Chase, but I'm going to do it." And it turned out that Chase did protect the rights of the black man. So that is quite a contrast to today's world.
Near the end of your book, you have an editorial that reads like this: "He has called around him in council the ablest and most earnest men of his country. Where he has lacked in individual ability, learning, experience, or statesmanship, he has sought it and found it. Force, energy, brains, earnestness he has collected around him in every department. Then the kicker. Were he not a blackguard and an unscrupulous knave in the end, he would undoubtedly command our respect as a ruler. We turn our eyes to Richmond, and the contrast is appalling, sickening to the heart. That was from the Charleston Mercury.
When I found that, isn't that incredible? I mean, it's so they understood that in some ways, you know, somebody once said that if the South and the North had traded leaders, if they had had Lincoln and we'd had Jefferson Davis in the North, and then we had traded generals, you know, the thing would have been so different. There's no question that they had, you could see from that editorial, even though they hated everything for which he stood, respect for him as a leader. And it's a great thing as a leader to recognize what your weaknesses are, who you need to shore up, and build other people around you, rather than needing to just dominate them and think of yourself as strong because you don't want to show your own weakness.
It is said that football coaches and musicians, conductors, are judged, the excellence of them is judged by the quality of the teams and organizations that follow after they've resigned or after they've left. Lincoln, of course, was assassinated after the Civil War was officially over. But in terms of what followed Lincoln, how can he be rated in terms of establishing something that would last?
Well, unfortunately, the choice of Andrew Johnson proved incredibly bad for the country. And I'm not sure that he's paid enough attention to what would be the likely leadership of Andrew Johnson. He had been a military governor in the South. He was good on the issue of slavery and one of the few people in the South that had kept the Union together. So I can see why he chose him. And he didn't know him very well. I'd like to believe that if Lincoln had really spent time with Andrew Johnson, he would have seen the weaknesses that this man would have brought to the presidency, because Reconstruction got all fouled up under his incapable hands.
It's a large book, folks. It's a heavy book, but it's a magnificent book. Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, written devotedly by Doris Kearns Goodwin. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Oh, what a great pleasure. Thank you, Mike. Wow.
And thank you at home for joining us. We have a toll-free number if you'd like to react to our programs or give us some comments and questions. That number is 800-424-9343. And you can visit us online at aarp.org/radio. There's an archive of previous broadcasts and streaming audio, now podcast form as well. Primetime Radio is a production of AARP. Our producer is Janelle Haskell, associate producer Rachel McCarthy. Our engineer is Bruce Youngblood. I'm Mike Cuthbert in Washington.